Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, and Greg Erickson of the Alaska Budget Report. The 90-day legislative session is underway in Juneau. Legislators gathered there this week, and Governor Sean Parnell gave his State of the State speech. Let's start with you, Paul. Give us some of the highlights of Parnell's State of the State.
Well, in addition to, gee whiz, it's great that you live here because I'm in charge, he talked about lowering taxes on the oil industry. He wants to set limits on spending at the end of the session. Talked about the federal government, criticized it roundly. Went on to want to suspend the 8 cent per gallon gas tax, and he's really trotted out his initiative against domestic violence and pounded away at that, trying to look for support. I talked about his merit scholarships, the film industry, and he has great confidence in AGEA. So I know I slept better that night.
Okay. Tim, I found the speech, the tone of this speech is, you never had it so good, but.
Well, I think a lot of people that I talked to felt there was a little bit too much sweetness and light in it, too, that he really didn't speak to some of the longer-term systemic budget issues the state faces, structural. He didn't really deal with that very much. He knows it very well, and I think that surprised me. Seemed a little light in that
area.
Well,
that would have been a downbeat part of the message. Maybe he's going to save that for the budget address. He did talk about the need for fiscal prudence or restraint, right?
Yeah, he did. But still, I mean, given his background in the Finance Committee, and he was one of the architects of the, where he was active at the time, the legislature developed a five-year fiscal plan. There wasn't any talk of a fiscal plan or fiscal planning, and that, I think, surprised a lot of people.
Greg, your assessment?
Well, I think Paul left out the oil tax initiative that he mentioned in his...
We're going to have plenty of time to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. And I think that ties in with what Tim was saying, that any sort of discussion of the need for fiscal planning might raise the question of why we want to be cutting oil taxes at this time. I thought the speech was much better than his inaugural speech, which was pedestrian at best. But it wasn't anything that got the crowd standing and cheering, I don't think.
Now, it seemed to me that Governor Parnell has really adopted Wally Hickel's view of the federal government, the compact between the state and the federal government, what happened at statehood, and Parnell really emphasized either we got a raw deal or the dangers of the federal government. How accurate is he in characterizing what happened at statehood and how it affects us now?
Well, I think he's making a moral argument. Although he couches it in legal terms, I'm quite confident no legal basis to say that the federal government has violated the compact that has been made with Alaska. If there was, I'm pretty sure.
Well, Hickel went to court over that.
Hickel did and lost, and I'm pretty sure Parnell would go to court if he thought there was a chance of winning. But he is making the argument that. We had certain expectations as a party to this contract with Congress, and we don't think those expectations are being met. They're being frustrated, in other words. And that's a moral argument, I think, that resonates with a lot of Alaskans. I personally find the rhetoric kind of tiresome. It goes on, and it doesn't really accomplish much, I don't think.
Tim, meanwhile, legislators have their own priorities. What do lawmakers in the Senate and the House want to accomplish this year?
Well, at this time of the session, people are going to keep their cards a little close, particularly people who have influence and power on the finance committees aren't really going to talk about what their real agendas are. We do hear a few things, though. Obviously, the governor has got a fair amount of initiative behind his new Susitna Hydro project. That resonates very well for the Fairbanks legislators. As a matter of fact, the Fairbanks delegation is pretty much the architects of that policy getting going in the last couple of years. So I think that there's going to be a lot of support. A lot of people are going to give that priority. The bullet line, which seems to be a project that's losing some momentum because of the cost and other factors, But that's still the Kenai delegation. House Speaker Mike Chenault is very keen on that.
He certainly is in a position to influence it.
Wants to tweak the enabling legislation a little bit. Now, how that plays off against the hydro project, it's a little bit too early to tell. Senator McGuire is interested in endowing the Alaska Industrial Development Authority to go out and finance, you know, major energy projects around the state, other versions of CSITNA. A lot of ideas in energy. I think a lot of people, Senator Stedman, who's in an important position in the Senate Finance Committee, is very interested in getting the hydro project near Ketchikan off the ground. It was vetoed last year, so he wants that back. A lot of interest in energy.
And these are expensive projects and will take some time to complete.
All big ticket.
Let's go back to Greg. Greg, how would you describe the legislature's relationship with the governor, generally speaking? And then what did you observe last year?
Well, I think the governor has good relations with the legislators in both houses and in both parties, in contrast to his two predecessors, who had pretty lousy relations, I'd say. But I think it's maybe a mistake to look at it as just legislators as a whole. There's really three players here, the governor, the House, and the Senate, and sort of two against one usually wins. And I think Tim sort of characterized that, mentioned that very different views in Senate Finance and House Finance. In House Finance, the governor wanted to set a sort of informal spending limit for this session. House Finance folks said, "Oh, good idea, we'll be glad to talk about that." Senate Finance, Stedman said, thumbs down on that. We can't talk about that until we know how much money we have. And I think they're thinking about those big ticket items that they want to squeeze in, and they don't want to have some pre-existing limit that causes a problem. So, and as Tim accurately said, they're keeping their cards close to their vests, particularly in the Senate. The House a little bit more, I don't want to say open, but they tend to let it hang on their sleeve, I guess, a little bit more.
You want to add something to that, Tim?
Well, I think we're beginning to see a replay of what happened last year, too, where it seemed like the big decisions were shaped right at the end. And the senators, we got Lyman Hoffman and Bert Stedman, very, very experienced tacticians, and they don't say much about what their plans are till right to the end.
Okay, let's turn to Paul. Paul, speaking of relationship, professionally speaking, between Representative Kyle Johansen and Charisse Millette, they are now the caucus of two that is caucusing on their own, but they did get committee assignments.
Yes.
What's happening to them politically speaking?
I think they're at the back of the bus. They wound up, Johansen wound up on the State Affairs Committee, Millett's on the Health Committee. There was an organizational fracas early on. They wound up losing their positions in the caucus. Caucus refused to let them back in. They now say they're going to work and regain confidence in relationships, fix the relationships, and make their way back into the caucus.
Okay.
And that's where they are.
Well, they walked out of the caucus.
They walked out of the caucus, and they now can't get back in. So,
Greg, did it surprise you that this was, this seemed to be taking very personally?
Well, yeah, this has a personal overtone here. They were rumored to be romantically related, and they both have denied that, I guess. It surprised me that they walked out not realizing how much animosity there was, particularly among rural legislators in that coalition. And that rural coalition, the rural group within the Republican House coalition is stronger now than it was last time. And Bill Thomas in particular said, "No, you guys aren't coming back."
Greg, it seems that there are a number of people in the legislature now who are really unhappy with the 90-day session limit. And Senate President Gary Stevens has introduced a bill to change that. Tell us about what you know about the bill, if there are others as well, and why.
There are three pieces of legislation been introduced this year to overturn or otherwise change the 2005 initiative, which passed into statutory law a 90-day session limit. We already had a 120-day session limit adopted by amendment almost 20 years ago now, I guess. And the statutory limit has been abided by legislators since 2005, but they have chafed under that limit and argue that public input is particularly limited in that shorter period of time. Gary Stevens, the Senate president, introduced a bill to keep the 90-day limit for the first year's regular session, but to have a 120-day limit for the second year session. His theory is that the second session of a legislature regular session is always the one where everything gets finally done in the end, and you need more time. Representative Carl Gatto has proposed exactly the opposite arrangement, whereby you'd have 120 days in the first year of the session and then 90 days in the second session. And he's coupled that with a proposal to have a biennial budget. And Max Gruenberg in the House has proposed just repealing the initiative altogether.
And that's it in a nutshell. Okay, thank you, Greg. Tim, following the Joe Miller, Lisa Murkowski tight race and write-in that Senator Murkowski won, there's been a lot of discussion in the legislature of changing the election laws, particularly as they apply to write-ins. But then people have been saying, no, we need some other changes as well. Gruenberg had talked about a bill to get restore the open primary. What do you make of this, out of this? And when it comes to being an expert on legislation, aren't all legislators experts on election law?
I suppose they are. Well, the Lisa Murkowski write-in was certainly a kind of a history-making event that all of us watched with great interest. I'm not sure that, there'll be a lot of discussion about it, but I'm not sure in the end that people are going to feel that the way the courts interpreted the laws, it was all that bad. It turned out fine in terms of the statute held up, the courts interpreted it, and I'm not sure that there's a wide appetite for just a lot of change to it.
Let's get Greg back in here.
There is legislation been introduced, and I can't recall who introduced it, to basically codify in statute what the court said, that the intent is what's important. So, and I think that might move forward.
Okay. That would be something that would make a lot of sense.
And it would certainly be the simplest things to do, but it's been my experience with the legislature that when you get into election law, people say, well, then there's something else that's bothering me, and let's talk about this. And that's typically a problem. Okay, oil taxes. Paul, Governor Parnell is determined to change our oil tax regime, and so is Representative Mike Hawker, and there are others as well, and Speaker of the House has talked about it too. What do the revisers have in mind, and what are the prospects for changing the tax regimen soon?
It's going to be tough. What the governor wants to do is essentially, over a period of, I guess, from 2013 to 2017, pull out more than $5 billion in taxes and allow the oil industry to keep that. To do that, he's going to put a cap on the progressivity surcharge.
Progressivity.
I can say that easily, sure. 50% would be the new cap for fields and production, 40% for new fields, the idea being, we want you to build new fields. We want you to punch new holes. We'll give you a break. It also has tax incentives and that sort of thing. Mike Hawker and others are looking at a different kind of stair-step bracket with a 20% base rate, which is it's now at 25%. It goes up in increments. At the top increment, you're paying the same tax rate all the way to the bottom, which is fairly expensive. They're trying it from that approach. I don't think it's going to do very well in the Senate. They find out now at this late date, well, the Department of Revenue really can't tell us exactly what ACES has done to investment on the North Slope or to the tax structure. So now we got to figure out what exactly did ACES do. And Revenue goes so far as to say, hey, well, you know, we can't tell you what it did, but the production is dropping. So I think we're in a
position.
But
that would be true anyway. Right? I mean,
production is dropping. That's the only thing they know is what we all know. Okay. So I think it's going to be a problem. I think they're going to have to get information, go outside, get information. And if they get it done next year, I'd be surprised.
Let's get Tim in here. Tim, has public opinion solidified either for or against ACES?
Mike, this is so complicated. The public, it's very difficult for the public to understand it, even for most legislators to understand it. There are different interpretations of the numbers. Are we gaining jobs? Are we losing jobs? Investment going up? Investment going down? I think there's an unease in the public that things aren't going as well as they should. They know contracting work and employment is down on the slope. Contractors aren't hiring as many people. People are worried about the pipeline declining in throughput faster than what was anticipated. The figure is now 7% a year, and it has been over the last year and a half. It used to be 6%, 5%. And what that means, in 3 or 4 years, we're going to be down at the point where there starts to be some operational issues with the pipeline. So the public hears that kind of thing, and they worry that something is amiss here and we should do something to try to turn that around.
Does anybody know or have an informed, educated opinion if you change the tax regimen right now in whatever way legislature thought was appropriate with the governor, how soon it would take to make a difference? Can we know that?
You don't know, and this is the problem with this bill, is that there are no guarantees. You can't say, the industry can't say that it will invest more money. It probably will. It will probably create some more jobs. It'll bring some more oil, whether it's enough to really make a difference. But the way the legislators look at it is, we're giving up $5 billion, and of course that would be money spent on state employees and services and things like that.
And capital projects.
So, yeah. Capital projects. So what, you know, you're giving up a known quantity versus this intangible on the other
side.
Let's
pursue that with Greg. Greg, does anybody know how much the state would be giving up? Dermot Cola's quoted a figure, which presumably comes from the state, of $1 billion a year for the next 5 years. There may be other figures, but is there any way to know that?
Well, the state Department of Revenue issued an official fiscal note on the governor's proposal. And at the Alaska Budget Report, we read those things very carefully. And it, the $5 billion, the $1 billion a year that Dermot mentioned in his column, is what the number that's in that official fiscal analysis. But that analysis only covers part of the things in the bill that will cost the state money. All the doesn't make any estimate of the increase in the credits or the deductions or the incentives, which could themselves be over $500 million a year. It's just, they just don't estimate it. So all I can say is that there is, there was a second report issued by the Department of Revenue, I think Paul was referring to it, which came out the day after the governor introduced his bill. And when we pored over the Department of Revenue's report, it was very surprising to us because it almost made the case against changing the taxes. I mean, I don't say almost, I think it did make a case for not messing with it anymore. And I don't know how it came to be released the day after the governor, but maybe Tim.
Tim's smiling. There's something going on here.
Well, you know, I've read this, I've followed this thing very closely, and I think that report was very carefully written. And there's things in that report that both sides can use. And the, you know, for example, you'll find in there a graph which shows a very dramatic decline in exploration drilling. I mean, we're at the lowest level that we have been in many years. Well, that's one thing that one side can use. We have in there some data showing increasing or at least stable investment projections by the companies which they provide. Well, that's information the other side can use. And you have a statement by the department which really walks tiptoes down through the middle as to whether the spending is for activities like drilling, which create more oil, or whether it's just maintenance.
Are we going to hear some argument at some point about, okay, let's say we're going to create 6,000 jobs, and 2,000 of those are going to come from people who are in Louisiana and Washington State and California. We'll go through all that stuff again.
I'm sure the Fairbanks people have strong opinions about that.
They have strong opinions about everything. Yeah.
But you know, Tim, what struck me is, if you are a governor and the Department of Revenue works for you, you don't send out a report that says, well, on the one hand, maybe it could be a good idea, on the other hand, maybe it's a bad idea. You send out a report that says either nothing or supports the governor's program.
Well, but the report was required by statute, and it was prepared by the professional economists in the Department of Revenue, and I think they felt that they had an obligation to present their view professionally and not get caught up in a partisan. What was interesting, though, is that the statement that they don't know what, you know, how the statement, you know, how the spending is broken out. They can't describe where the money goes. And that's sharply in contrast to what Commissioner Galvin has said several times verbally, that they do know where the money goes, that so much of it goes, what percentage goes to maintenance, what percentage goes to drilling.
Well, they actually categorized it in earlier reports. between operating and capital.
And capital, but they would not break out how much of the capital went to new projects like drilling and how much just to maintenance. Maintenance meaning pipeline repairs and things like that.
Yeah, but we want them to spend that. I mean, that was one of the things we gave credits for. Yeah, you can't keep the oil flowing unless they spend that.
Oh, you should spend. There's no argument with that.
Paul here, but I'm going to go back to Greg for one thing. from an economic perspective, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like, in part, this is an argument about income redistribution, that the money would come in, this $1 billion, it goes into the state treasury, it's spent in this kind of way, and the hope is this $1 billion will go out into the economic field of all of Alaska and be spent by presumably good citizens in other ways. Is that right or wrong?
Well, sure, but the governor wants to characterize it as an argument about jobs. And what he'd like to have the question framed as is, will cutting these taxes increase jobs? And if that's the only question you ask, it probably sounds like a pretty good idea. If you want to go be further than that and say, how much are we going to give up for every job created? Well, that yields a very different answer, although it's also one where there's no hard and fast number.
Let's go to Tim real quick, and I got to get Jenkins in here.
The other aspect, though, is the effect of the taxes stimulating more oil going through taps. I mean, that's a serious issue we have to face with. If that pipeline goes down, we're toast.
We almost found out. Yeah. Paul.
The way ACES is crafted, at least two economists that you read from, the way it takes out about $1 billion to $1.3 billion a year more than it would if it was crafted like a normal progressive tax anywhere else in the world. So what we're talking about is, he's talking about the $5 billion. He had taken out $1 billion too much a year. It's just not going to go to the state. It's going to go to the industry. So that's what it comes
down to. We need to move on, but let's stay with Paul Jenkins while we're moving on. Paul, the Anchorage School District is about to make some major cuts. I think this comes as quite a surprise to members of the community.
Surprise!
Given the price of oil and what the legislature can do. Tell us about it.
The school district budget is like $635 up to $811 when you count in food service and the federal programs and all of that. Despite that, so we're looking at a $9 to $12 million deficit next year. That's going to require cuts.
And did you check on the total budget of the school district? I didn't.
The total budget's $811 million.
$811 million, okay.
So what we've wind up with is summer school eliminations for elementary school, middle school, interscholastic sports being cut, graduation coaches, the guys and women who go out and keep the kids in school and keep them coming to school. And, I had a hard time understanding what it was they did, but apparently it's a very important job. We're going to be an assistant principal go and some secretaries and things like that as we try to get the budget back in balance. None of this includes, I suppose I should say, any of the stimulus money, the $60 or $70 million they got. That was spent, Carol Como says, on one-time expenditures. What few things they did spend that would carry over, they'll have to worry about that later.
Okay,
but right
Greg,
now we're short.
Juneau is going to be affected too, the Juneau School District and districts all around the state. Tell us about that.
Well, it's much the same picture that Paul painted. Two problems. We've had there was a deal worked out among legislators and the governor 3 years ago to increase the per student state aid allocation by $100 per year per student. And the current fiscal year is the last year of that arrangement, so there's no increase scheduled for next year. Districts have gotten used to using that, and they received these stimulus monies that are going away. And the House Finance folks said day before yesterday, or last week, I guess I should say, that over our dead bodies, are we going to put any of that money back in? But I think there's going to be a concerted push from the school districts, and they'll come down and they'll claim they're going to have to lay people off if they don't get some increases in the formula funding.
So Carol Como's already said that.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a big. The House Finance folks say they're adamantly against that. And Mike Hawker, Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, was on that group that made the original proposal, and I think he's probably with his House colleagues. In the Senate, I think they'll get a much better reception.
Let's stick with you, because we are going to run short of time, and that another big topic that's going to perhaps involve a lot of money is Medicaid funding. It's a complicated topic, so if you could tell us about it.
Well, and the federal government's share of Medicaid, it's a joint state-federal program, and the federal government and the state share the cost of it. During the economic recession of 2008-2009, the federal government said, hey, we'll, as a special deal to help stimulate the economy, we'll raise the federal share from what it would normally have been. But that stimulus provision goes away this year, and our share drops way down, and there's a $123 million hole in the governor's budget if Congress doesn't put it back. Doesn't seem like much likelihood of Congress putting it back. David Teal, the Director of Legislative Finance, yesterday told the House Finance Committee that he thought it would be a good idea to put a provision in the budget that says, hey, if they don't put it back, we get the $123 million, so we don't have to cut services. Bill Thomas, the co-chair of House Finance, said, over our dead body.
And over our dead body, too, because we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week right here on Anchorage Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.